Hey, y'all. My name is Ann Wyatt. I started my career in workforce development with the state of Kentucky in 2010. That experience ignited a deep passion for manufacturing within me. I started this show hoping to raise more awareness around the bright outlook manufacturing careers have. Join me as I sit down with some of the manufacturing industry's most successful change makers and learn how they're partnering people with technology. It's time to give people more meaningful work. This is Workforce 4.0. Hey, y'all. Welcome back to another episode of Workforce 4.0. I'm your host, Ann Wyatt. I am so excited to have Montez King with us here today. Montez and I met a couple of weeks ago at IMTS. We did a panel together on the job descriptions and how we can make those more creative for incoming workforce generations. But Montez is most known for his work through NIMS skills. And he is here today to share with us some impactful insights about how we can get started as a small, medium enterprise on initiating training and development for our frontline workforce. So thank you, Montez, so much for being here. I'm so excited.
And thank you for having me. What an honor it is to be on your show. I'm really happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
I am thrilled to have you. As I've told you, I've been really wanting you to come on the show for a while now. So I appreciate your time today for sure.
Oh, we made it work.
For those that are out listening in the audience today, is there anything that you want to share with them in case they have been unaware of what NIMS does or who Montez is? Is there anything else you want to add to that intro and just share with our listeners today?
Oh, I will not. No, you just did a great job. I will not interfere with that. Thank you so much. That was a kind introduction.
Thank you. Thank you. No, I'm very aware of the work that you all are doing. Actually, I often see a lot of certifications when I'm recruiting on resumes of candidates. With really? The NIM certifications. Yes, I really do. But I work a lot in metals and stuff. Yeah.
That's really cool. I've never personally earned a NIM credential myself. I guess I wouldn't qualify since I'm directing the team that develops the credentials, but I have taught people in the classroom and they've earned credentials before I started working here. And it felt like I remember the first person that earned a credential that I've taught. And he fell out of his chair when it said pass. He's like, oh, he just fainted and fell right down. And I was right there with, it was a really good feeling. I really enjoyed the opportunity to see someone earn something they've worked so hard and is passionate, keeps it close to their heart. So.
Oh, I love that. Doesn't that make you feel so good?
It does. Yeah. Makes you feel good about your work. You're making a change in life where you're impacting someone's life that, as a lifetime of pleasure.
Exactly. You're getting them started on their career journey. That makes me so happy. I love that. So Montez, I know this is your first time on Workforce 4.0, but we've got to give you the initiation and we got to know out there. We've got burning questions. What is your go-to karaoke song or your favorite song?
Oh, wow. That's a really hard question. That depends on my mood. If I'm on a date, maybe it's a difference. If I'm about to do something adventurous the next day, I don't know. But for workforce development, I got a song for you. No Easy Way Out. Robert Tapper, I think it is. No Easy Way Out. Yeah, Rocky movie. Remember Rocky?
Yeah.
I think he was fighting a Russian. And he said, there's no easy way out. There's no shortcut.
Oh, my gosh.
Hey, that's workforce development. We got to face this. We can't take any shortcuts with it.
I love that.
That's what comes to mind right now.
We need to get you on our next karaoke endeavor. We need you to sing that. And we need to invite all the folks out there that are in the manufacturing industry. And they need to hear that, I think.
How about we all sing it together and we make the beat with our mouths say, dun, 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 there's no easy way out. Dun, 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 dun. All do that together.
Absolutely. Yes. Maybe. This should be actually, instead of doing a panel next time, let's just sing that song on stage.
Yeah, we'll just sing it. I'm with you. You and I, we'll do it.
And you know what? Megan would be here for that. So the next time she puts together one of these panels, this is what we're doing, Megan.
A trio, whichever way you want to do it.
She'd get up there with us. She'd be all on that. Awesome. I love that. That is very much the message of, I think, workforce development that I think we've probably both been shouting from the rooftops for years. Oh, thank you. But that's amazing. So I'm passionate about workforce development, obviously, but I want to know more about you and what you're passionate about, and like, why is workforce?
That's a good question as well. I would say it's a hard question to answer because there's so many facets of that. But I'd say what comes to mind now is I have to really go back thinking about myself and where did I want to go with my life and career. You're at a point where you're going to make a decision of what you want to do. And honestly, at that time, whatever was going to make me money, that's what I was looking at. But finding a passion in the metalworking industry, I did find a passion in that. But I decided to forego going to traditional school, college, and I went and I worked on a job. And I have my, I'll call it journey person. Back in the day, we call it journeyman. It's a journey person papers. And, I served a 4-year apprenticeship. I hang it on my wall. It's actually in my office. When I went to school, I got the degrees. And I don't hang those up because my greatest experience was those 4 years on that apprenticeship. I learned so much about life. I learned about a world that I didn't know existed. I often tell people, I say, when I thought about a bank account, that was my shoebox, right? You just put your money in the shoebox. When I thought about when I got paid at the end of the week, I would go to the liquor store and cash my check, put the big roll of money there, and then I put the big bills on top, little ones in the middle, put it in my pocket. I didn't know anything about credit and buying homes, anything like that. And going into the workplace and just seeing all these things around me, it really helped me. And so when I think about those experiences and all the other people in this world that could use those experiences, why not go into workforce development? You can get someone in something more than a high school diploma, less than a 4-year degree, get them in 6 months, you can put them in the middle class, right? They can start earning money. So working in those areas, there's no greater reward to see someone's life impacted by that kind of change and just helping them to see a world that they don't know exists. So workforce development, that's the way.
I love that so much. And I think some of the most impactful conversations have been over my experience in workforce development were with the frontline workforce. And talking about that and hearing very similar stories. And that's really what drew me into manufacturing. It's life-changing. And it gives so many opportunities. So that's amazing. What was your first role as a journeyman?
I'll take you back even further. I was 14 when I was introduced to the machine shop. And I went to a trade school. But that was a miracle for me because I didn't do so well in middle school. I was in class doing all types of stuff, right? I wasn't really into school. But then when I found out about machine shop, there was a trade school. I didn't get in through my grades. It was because no one else would go into machine shop. So they say, we have these openings. You could go in there. But I worked there. I was in school and I paid attention to everything that the instructor said, and that impressed them. And they gave me an opportunity to work at 16 on work study. I went to Teledyne Energy Systems. I'll never forget that. 16 years old, I had a high top fade.
Nice.
and I was pretty eclectic back then. I can get that way now. Sometimes I still bring that out, but came into the shop and I was basically sweeping floors and cleaning chips from machines and just asking a lot of questions. That's what I did for 2 years. And every now and then I get to pull a handle or roll a handle. And then I think about 2 years later, I was about to guess I was going to college. That's what my mind was thinking. And my supervisor came to me and said, what about apprenticeship? Why are you going to go to college? And I said, well, how much did that pay? He said, $10 an hour. I said, what? $10? Like back then? You make $10 an hour? That's like, only people made that kind of money in my neighborhood were drug dealers. Right? You didn't go to a job. You make $3.85 an hour. So yeah, I was an apprentice in the machine shop, and I started off there and just worked my way up. It's beautiful. I loved every minute of it.
That's amazing. And it's interesting that, so you, based on what you're telling me, you really didn't really have an interest in traditional education is what I'm hearing. You weren't I'm super excited to be in this school for 8 hours just learning about these things. But you walked in there and it was like, oh, this is cool.
We were poor growing up. We didn't have any money really. And I had to work really hard. I had to have a car to drive to go to work when I was on work study. And so I sacrificed any pleasure that you could think about when I was 14, 15 years old. I just did anything I could. I'll polish your shoes and make some money, whatever I could. And after making, I think I earned like $400. It's a little over that. And I had to get a car and then get insurance. And back then it was called, I maybe have it now, made for something like that. There was some kind of insurance where you had where it was expensive because I was 16 on my own insurance, paying $236 a month back in 1989. I was paying $236 a month. So that was it. Everything you worked for was there. I was just broke, wearing two or three pair of pants, recycling them over and over again. A few shirts, wear my uniform wherever I would go. So it was hard. And I was getting through school and on the work study program. And when I thought about college, I'm like, 4 years of being broke? I just could not see it. So you think about, I like working with my hands. Someone's offered me a job where I can make $10 an hour at that time, it's a lot more today. And so doing something I like to do, and I can still go to school part-time at night and make money. Oh, it was an easy decision for me. I'm like, no, I'm not going to sit in a classroom for 4 years and be broke. And I can do it. I can still learn and have a job. So I made that decision. My dad, he was so upset with me. Your family at that time, they work hard. When you touch their hands, it's really hard, callous hands, because they didn't have the education. They had to work more labor jobs. But then the way they judged success for their kids, my cousins, all of us, was whose kids went to college and what college you went to. So me coming and saying, I'm not going to go to college. I'm going to work in a machine shop. You can imagine the thoughts. What is he doing? Why? And so I don't think for maybe 2 years, I just got a big smile and a firm handshake. How you doing, son? That was what you got. Because you really judge your success on what college you went to. But I think the first time that he said you made a really good decision, he's always 8th grade education, but he's always done things with his hands. And he always worked for himself. And he was doing a few jobs out there. And one of his customers was, he went to one of his customers' facility, and they were all standing around and they were talking about this guy in this magazine. And they were just looking and said, oh, look at that. Isn't this a nice story? They were just reading. And my father comes over and he says, what are you guys doing? What's going on over here? They said, oh, look at this guy in this magazine. Look at what he's done and what he's doing with his life. He said, that's my son. He did not know I was in the magazine. I was a centerfold and he did not know it. And he walked and he said, that's my son. So he called me up. I think that's when he said, I'm proud of my son. This is serious. He said, that's my son. It was just a coincidence. Yeah.
What magazine was it?
I'll have to send that to you. I can't even remember the name of it. I actually have a copy of it, but I send that to you probably on the internet.
I can't imagine my kiddo. I can't imagine looking at just opening up a magazine and there's Phoenix.
Yeah.
That would be so wild. That is so wild.
Wow.
Back to your just hope I answered your question there. My first role was in the machine shop, and that was a bold move, bold decision for me to make at that time.
That's amazing. And obviously that hard work has paid off tremendously. And I'm glad that, albeit through a magazine, your dad at least recognized that and reached out to you.
He meant well. It's just like I said, the way it's all embedded in your mind that a 4-year degree is the best way to achieve success and make money. And I don't know if it was ever true at a certain time, but I know it's not true today. The new economy doesn't say that. More than 50% of the jobs in this country right now require something more than a high school diploma and less than a 4-year degree. And then if you go to the jobs that require a 4-year degree, most of them pay less than the jobs that don't require a degree. So got to do the math.
You really do. And that was something that I think I was surprised about early on in my career in workforce development. Seeing that was crazy. I was like, what? You mean to tell me I went and got a bachelor's degree to make a quarter? I'm making a quarter of what this, what this person sitting across from me is making.
Yeah.
Like,
I know I broke 6 figures before I was 30 years old. That's amazing. I worked a lot of overtime, but how many jobs? You can think about, even if your salary, that you still, in many cases, work over 40 hours.
Yeah, definitely. And then you're at overtime and you get time and a half. And
a great bonus. Time and a half. Yeah, I love that bonus. Yeah,
absolutely. So I think that's such an impactful story. And I'm sure from a parent perspective, it's like, you work so hard and you want better for your children and all of that. And I think that's where this whole narrative about going and getting that traditional 4-year degree has come from. But now we've done that to the point of where we're facing a very large skills gap in the industry. And I know NIMS has a program to help manufacturing companies overcome that. And one piece of that is really about tribal knowledge, because that is a huge hot topic in the industry. How do we preserve tribal knowledge? Because all of our workforce is moving on, and because we have so many of the younger generations pursuing those 4-year degrees, we're not able to preserve that tribal knowledge like we need to.
That's a good point. I know when I started out, you're talking 30 years though, knowledge transfer was not the culture at that time. It was, no, you keep everything to yourself for job security. And that was a big thing. If you were to ask a professional or a master in the trade how he's doing something, they'll smile at you and say, it's a secret. Do it very carefully. They don't really get into the nuts and bolts of it. How do you get away from that? Why? You talk about tribal knowledge, what's the definition of it, right? It's when your greatest document isn't something written down, but it's a person, right? All the secrets, the wiggles and the jiggles about what you do is in the head of a person. And obviously when that person leaves the company, that knowledge leaves with them. But then most companies rely on that. There are two things companies rely on. They rely on people 50 and older to get the work out the door. And they rely on tribal knowledge to get the work out the door. If you were to speak with any manufacturing company, if you say, who's really has all the knowledge and wisdom to actually solve the product, get the work out the door, that age is going to be somewhere in the 50s, and it's going to be tribal to those people. But when you think about it, we have to eliminate this problem. Like, how do we fix it? And then most people will just say, okay, we got to create this skills list, this competency list. We got to identify all of our competencies. And you might think, I'm solving my issue by writing down all the competencies. But these lists, these tasks, let's really think about that. Is that really the tribal piece? I don't know. If you take down all the things, all the different tasks of setting up and running a machine, right, and you say, and you think that's tribal, to me, it's really more about, if I look at any particular task, what would an expert show me if they were teaching me? What would they talk about? when they're teaching me, and what's acceptable performance is what's tribal. That's what they hold. Knowing what you, the tasks that need to be done, yeah, that's valuable, but it's not necessarily tribal. Right? Many people in the shop can identify that. But the ones that are holding that truth is inside of the what you show, what you talk about, and what's acceptable. And if you can nail that, one, you got to get that information, and then you got to organize it in a way where other people can understand it. Because if you know what the tribal knowledge is, but you can't organize it in a way and make it accessible to other people, then what, it brings no more value. It just sits on a shelf and it collects dust. Yeah, so it's really identifying what is the most valuable piece of information that's being held that's tribal, and how to extract that information, how to organize it in a way and make it accessible for anyone to understand. Those are the key pieces. Now, I just gave you high level, but that's what needs to be done with any manufacturer or any company that relies on tribal knowledge, tribal elders to get work done.
So do you think that maybe we're not overreacting, but do you think that maybe it's more about, maybe this term is being slightly dramatic, and maybe we need to document our processes, and maybe it's separating that need as opposed to tribal knowledge being like one of your maintenance guys hears a motor of one of the machines and it's making a funny noise, and they know they're like, this motor's fixing to die, you know, we need to go ahead and replace this.
Yeah. You think about it, if you document your process, that's important. You do it, right? It's important, and you need to do that. But, within the process, that I always call, there's always a wiggle and a jiggle in the process, right? You got to make it work. You got to get, yeah. And those are the things that are usually tribal. And so you have to have the process and the wiggle and the jiggle. Those are to make it together. And then there's another piece to it. Whatever you discover, it has to be dynamic in a way that it can be updated, because all of it changes. It doesn't sit, it's not static, it changes. And so if you spend all this time, you say, okay, I get it, Montez. Okay, we're gonna identify our processes, we're gonna get the wiggle and the jiggle, we're gonna organize in a way where everyone can understand it. And then 6 months later, there's more wiggle that comes in there, right? Then the machine is a little older. There's a little bit of change here. Things need to be adjusted. So any of that information that you discover has to be dynamically updated as well. So you're going to need technology to do that. It has to be smart technology that can be dynamically updated over time as things change. And it has to be, everything's connected. It's like you're creating a digital twin of your floor. And so when something changes, we always talk about digital twin when it comes to making something. About a digital twin training? It's the same thing. Yeah, so this is what we teach people. NIMS, you want to know a little bit about NIMS. It's not just about certifications. We go into companies and we help them to enhance their training and make it just as smart as their manufacturing processes.
That's awesome. Yeah. And that's super. That's digital twin is such a big buzzword when it comes to data and machine data and all of that. But every time that you implement or you add technology to your process, then you have people data as well that kind of plays into that.
Yes, that's the missing piece. Your digital twin of your factory is not just the equipment, the lines, the products that you're making, but it's also the people and the knowledge in which they have and the assignments of that. You have to put that into place as well. So you say, wow, if we add this and we do this, we could get 100% efficiency. Yeah, if people knew if they had the skill sets as well. So you have to factor that into your twin. And not just what they know now, but if they don't know, I have the knowledge or the skills, how long will it take you to get them knowledgeable and to attain those skills?
Yeah, that's also one of the biggest things that I hear from companies. They say, we train somebody, but it takes so long.
point.
So being able to identify the different training needs that a company has and putting together a timeline for them, that's also well within what NIMS does. How do we make accurate decisions on that from a management perspective? Like, how do we identify employees on the front line that are ready for training? And then how do we make sure that the decisions that management is making are accurate and not just from a feeling or not just from this employee, we work well together, he shows up on time, or she's dedicated to the job and she's a quick learner. How do we assess that in a metrics driven way?
Those are really good points. I'll try to break that just at really high level, just for the sake of time here. But what's key is you need data, right? And then from data, you got to be able to visualize so that you can make these decisions. But what are the data points? And at which point are you collecting that data? All those things have to be decided. And so you need a framework, training framework that fits within what we call your natural flow. It's like, we got an employee, I say, give him an example of what the natural flow of work is, and he'll do his dance. Natural flow, right? So usually training should work within your workflow of the company rather than your workflow adjusting to the training. And then within that workflow, there's data points that you're collecting data. Many people today will still say, if you talk about collecting data for training, I don't have time for that. But there was a time where we would say we didn't have time to collect data about our manufacturing processes. But today we rely on that, using ERP systems and understanding how long it took to do the job, how many hours we had on this job, our efficiencies. Even with our finances, we're always collecting data on our finances to help us make decisions. When it comes to training, we don't think about incorporating the data points that we need for training to better understand that. I think that's going to change definitely within this decade that we're in. Hopefully, that's not going to take 10 years, but we're getting to the point where people are starting to understand that an excuse to say, I have no time, it's not going to fly, because you need to stay competitive. And then the other pieces, what are the metrics? Now, I can give you a couple of them as an example, but a trailing metric or a metric such as profits up, scrap down, right? Profits high, low scrap. That is not a metric for training. And training can account, if you have all your people in their great workforce, that doesn't account for a bad CEO, right? That doesn't account for a bad COO. See, there's other variables in your product, your production going up and your scrap going down. There's so many other variables. So any metric that we identify for a company are direct, right? It's not trailing, it's direct. You can see it right there at the moment. You can't account for someone's trained, but as an employee that just doesn't have work ethics. So those are all variables, but yeah, the metrics have to be direct metrics. And we help organizations establish what those metrics are, where you're actually collecting data, and it's done in the natural flow. So you're not, it's minimum impact on production, where you're not offsetting production to get this data. It's just in your flow.
There's right.
A lot more to it. Is at a high level. You need, that's the key, is you need data visualization to make better decisions. You might say, we need to train our people, but that's really not a problem. Blame it on, I tell people all the time, I say, you're the training manager, right? Yeah, I'm the training manager. Okay. So if your superiors, people that you work for, upper management, they're saying, we've got problems on the floor, or we've got problems with production, and you cannot make an argument of why training or why your workforce is trained, they're going to blame you for it. They're going to say, they just don't know how to do the work. And that is the ASL sign. Maybe they don't know. But if you don't have the data and be able to visualize it, how can you be sure? How can you make a good decision? Very important when it comes to training.
Absolutely. Do you feel like maybe do you hear that a lot when you're implementing training to manufacturing companies? Do you hear like production values as a training metric?
Well, I constantly hear when we're working with an organization and we're identifying the metrics that they, this is something as simple. I don't want to take too much of the time into this subject, but I want to make sure I'm cognizant of our time together. But yes, most companies that we work with are using metrics that are not going to empower you to make really good decisions about training itself. They are, I call them trailing metrics because it's a term out there. It's if I want my production to go up, as a leader of a company, the decisions I made 6 months ago are going to impact where I am. 6 months ago will impact today, right? You can associate training as a factor into your production 6 months prior as a factor, but you just have to remember it's not the only factor. So how do you help a company to determine that it's not a training problem is what you're really looking for, rather than it is a training. We just need to put more and more into training. Because any manufacturer, they're not a training outfit. They're not an educator. Training is right. Just a part of the responsibility they have to stay profitable. But as training is not what you do as a company itself. So you have to keep that in mind when you're identifying.
Yeah, no, if it were me, and you weren't privy to that knowledge, or if you weren't an educational provider, I think that's a really easy thing to look at and say, we must need training. And anyone that is inclined to do that and then reach out to a provider like NIMS, that's at least you're making that first step. Yeah. At least you're saying, what can we do better? And how can we help our people?
And how it's working. Whatever you put in place, how do you know it's working? And this is where we're going back to data and visualization. Because if you decide that it is a training problem, at least it's a big factor and you're going to address it through training. Now, once you put that in place, again, how do you know it's working? You say, oh, because production is up. I don't know about that. The planets aligned. You got other factors could make your productivity up here. Doesn't necessarily. Now, if training just happened to be an initiative that you had 6 months or a year ago and production is up, now you've got the false impression that training was what made you more profitable. And it may or may not be true. Maybe you just got some people in there. You just happen to, you hire people from Starbucks and Walmart, and they happen to do better when you get them from another area. And you just happen to get good people despite your training efforts. You don't know that.
That's true. So what are some things from your experience in implementing these types of programs? Like, what are some things that you do look for to indicate the success of training?
I'll give you, there's some metrics you can use, such as you mentioned that it takes too long. People say, I bring people in and it takes too long, right? Usually what we do for a company is we give them what we call a max time date. The minute or the second that you assign someone learning a training plan, right? There's what we call the official clock starts to tick. And if your expectation is they need to get there in 6 months, that clock is going to tick regardless of what you do. We didn't train them today because production was too heavy over here. So we moved in this department, the clock doesn't care. It doesn't care if someone didn't show up. It doesn't care if the trainer had to do something twice, or that it's just going. And so we can measure you and see where you are on the master clock versus the progress in the training plan. Other things we can look at is anytime you're training, there has to be an opportunity to train. For example, if you're going to teach someone to use this specific machine and this specific process or application, then that it might not always be active on the floor. So you have to wait for the opportunity, right? And sometimes production demand takes precedence over training someone. So I put the person that can do the work more productively and less time into training. So we help companies detect their training opportunities for any person or any area that they need the training, and how many of those opportunities they've accepted versus denied. Because if there were 100 opportunities to train someone in this specific thing, right, And you've only taken 10% of those opportunities because production took precedence. Then who do you have to blame for these people not learning how to do the job? Now, if you didn't have this metric, then you would say, oh, it's a training issue. No, the training's fine. You're just not doing it.
Right.
You're saying, I'm going to sacrifice training for production. Or you could say, I'm going to sacrifice a little bit of production for training for the long haul. But if you don't have the data, if you can't visualize that, you can't see exactly where you are. So this is where we help them to be. Those are just small examples of what we do for a company to help them make better decisions about their workforce.
No, that makes so much sense. And I feel as small businesses, you get in that cycle, like you get caught there because it's like you're do or die if you don't do production. Production is do or die. And then you do have to dedicate that time for adequate training, and but then you've got POs to make and demand. So it's really difficult. Would you say there's probably a healthy level of patience that has to be applied in this process?
The one thing that we don't or we stay away from is telling the business what decisions they should make. But if you make a take a married couple, right? Just an example. They're going to make some decisions in life. They've got to be in agreement on that decision. Because if one person makes a decision and the other one just accepts it and goes with it, if that's a bad decision, I told you not to do that. Yeah. You got to be yoked into that. You got to be together and you got to say, okay, we're going to make this decision. And if we fail, if we succeed, but we do this together.
It's group ownership.
Yeah, you got to have the connection. See that? You got a connection. Your management team, your people on the floor, they got to be connected in this way. And if a company decides that we are going to sacrifice production or training for production, we know what we're doing. We know why we're doing it. So when if that becomes a bad decision in the future, we don't go back and say it's this person's fault or that team's fault. It's more about we made a collective decision. We had the data. We could visualize it. We knew where we were. We made the sacrifice. And then the next time you can say, no, we're not going to repeat this mistake. But without the data, without the visualizing it, now I call it muddy water. Everything's muddy. You can't see clearly through it because the water is muddy from everyone not really understanding or knowing what happened in the past or what having real data, reliable data to make a decision about your future. You need to understand where you are, have that data right now to do that. So we don't tell a company the decision you need to make, but we help them collect data to make better decisions. And if they fail or they succeed, they're doing it together.
Do you think that the companies that implement training the most effectively, do you see that reflective of them? Like they make decisions firmly and quickly and decisively and move forward on that decision. Do you think that's a sign of like companies that are taking that approach, are they more successful in that?
Yeah, you can go into some companies and their culture for training is rock solid. Your culture is never really what you say it is as the management team. It's really what your people say. And when you hear them speaking about it, it's so good here. Oh, if I were coming in from new into the company and I'm working with Ann and Ann's teaching me this, I can quickly say, oh man, she was trained to do this. She's really good. I can see it because now that culture starts to become a part of me. As far as decision-making, companies can make good decisions and it could be just by fluke, right? But that culture is still there and it has an impact. You just don't know exactly how it impacts. And you can have a good culture of training and you can still make bad decisions about training. But they're two different pieces. But I have seen some companies who have good culture, good systems in place. And when you have both of them, the decision-making becomes much easier and their shelf life on the company is expanded. You can think of several companies that have this culture. And I mean, you can look at Chick-fil-A. Look at how they're the kings of the fast food industry. Great training.
Drive-through. They run that drive-through. Airports should have envy of how Chick-fil-A runs their drive-through.
Yeah, there. And you can go anywhere. No matter where you are in the country. And you get the same consistency. It's amazing.
It is. It really is. No, that's, I think you make some really valid points. And that point about Chick-fil-A is interesting. If you could offer that same kind of world-class training, then it becomes more about the workforce at large and less about your specific company.
It's a combination of their work processes and training people to execute them, right? They don't work separately. It's together. And they have to be equally matched.
That's some great perspective. I think that's super interesting and very helpful for today's conversation. And I do want to be cognizant of your time as well. I know that we are running a little long today, but for those out in the audience that would love to learn more about NEMS or even just connect with the amazing Montez King, how can we get a hold of you?
You can go to our NEMS website. It's www.nims-skills.org. Now, if you want to learn about our new training framework and technology that can help you enhance your training and use some of the examples that we spoke about during this podcast, you can go to www.mystech.org. Go there and tour around and you'll see my face on there. You can get in contact with me through any of those sites. Look forward to hearing from you.
Awesome. Thank you, Montez. It has been such a good conversation today. And I am low key just in the back of my head, just thinking about all of these takeaways. So I'm sure that I'll be mentally delving more deeply into those throughout the rest of the day, because this has been really impactful for me. And I really appreciate you being on the show and sharing your wisdom with myself and the rest of our Workforce 4.0 community.
Thank you, Anne, for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you out there in the field.
Awesome. Yes, we will see you at the next show.
That's right. I'll be there.
Awesome. Are you going to, what is your next show? For those that are going to shows, how can they link up with you at a show?
Oh, man, I have to look on the calendar. I am not sure exactly where. I can tell you this. I was just at the IMTS, and that was a long one.
That was long. I was only there for 2 days. That is not fair for me to say that, because I knew some folks that I know were there all week long. And I am glad that I was only there for 2 days. And I was super low key about it, because I was like, I knew that I had to talk to very specific people during that event. And I knew that if I was like, hey, I'm going to be at IMTS, that those conversations would have never happened. So, and those conversations, like kind of the one that we had, which led to this conversation today.
It did, yeah. I was honored to meet you in person finally at the IMTS.
Thank you. The honor was all mine. You're very famous in the workforce development circle, so. That's amazing. But thank you again, Montez. I won't keep you. And for everybody else out there in the audience, thank you so much for tuning into Workforce 4.0. And we'll see you next week.